Welcome, everyone. So it's great pleasure to have Professor Tim Dietrich to be the strong gravity seminar speaker today. Tim was a junior scientist at AEI and a Marie Curie fellow at NICAF before 2020, and he joined the faculty of Potsdam University in 2020. His research interests include numerical relativity, gravitational wave, and kilonova modeling. Today, he's going to talk about the multi-messenger astronomy with neutron stars. Please take it away.
Yeah, thank you very much. First of all, thank you for this invitation. I already said it, I have never been to Perimeter yet. So I'm happy that at least online I can visit and be there. So in the strong gravity group, I'm sure that in particular the introduction, most of the people there are experts, so you know a lot of stuff, probably in some aspects more than myself. But nevertheless, I want to give a one slide introduction to why I will talk about binary neutron stars and why they are interesting. And I will highlight already the key aspects that later during the talk will become more and more important and where actually my research focuses on. And the first key point is, of course, nuclear physics, because you see it here in the bottom right, the QCD phase diagram, where you see that neutron stars actually are one of the only places in the universe where we can probe matter at densities well beyond nuclear saturation density, a few times nuclear saturation density, maybe up to 10 times and such or so. And in single neutron stars, we have this at very low temperatures, right? Isolated neutron stars have temperatures that compared to the Fermi temperatures very low. So this gives us a unique possibility to probe cold supranuclear dense matter of neutron-rich material. On the left side, you now see a QCD phase diagram of a numerical relativity simulation, where first of all, it's all scaled up to the nuclear saturation density. So you really see that in the simulation, you cover ranges up to maybe four times nuclear saturation density when you form black holes, even beyond. So really you probe the matter at the most extreme densities that you can produce in the universe before black hole formation. And furthermore, it's not just that you're doing binary neutron star mergers, look at cold supranuclear dense matter, you also look at hot matter, because you heat up the material when the two neutron stars merge, you reach dense temperatures up to 30, 40, 50 MeV. So this is quite extreme and therefore very interesting. And this nuclear physics aspect will be one of the important, let's say, science drivers for this talk today. Another thing is, of course, neutron stars are perfect sources for gravitational waves. So if you have an isolated neutron star, if this neutron star is deformed, then this will already emit gravitational waves. On the other hand, and this is what we have seen, and you all know this, we've seen the merger of two neutron stars in 2017, another merger of two neutron stars in 2019. And obviously, if you're coming from the gravitational wave astronomy side, then looking at binary neutron stars is, let's say, more appealing than just looking at a single neutron star yet, because we haven't seen gravitational waves from single neutron stars. Binary neutron star mergers are also connected to the formation of heavy elements, short gamma ray bursts, they offer tests of general relativity. And the last 2-3 minutes of this talk, I will also briefly talk about cosmology and actually how we can measure the Hubble constant in different ways from the gravitational wave and electromagnetic signal coming from binary neutron star mergers. And the method that we are applying, my group and with my collaborators, is that we actually do numerical relativity simulations, also at Perimeter. Of course, you're experts in NR simulations. And we use our simulations, let's say, as a testbed for create gravitational wave models as well as kilonova models, try to find the connection between the kilonova and the binary properties. And luckily, since now 4 years, we're able to connect theoretical predictions actually to observations. This includes gravitational waves. This includes also other messengers. And this is this multi-messenger picture that is also mentioned in the title. Of course, as I said, this refers to gravitational waves. We have seen yet gravitational waves from binary neutron stars from the InSpall. But if we see, or if we go beyond today's measurements, right, beyond today's gravitational wave detectors, maybe looking forward to the Cosmic Explorer or to the Einstein telescope, we will also see what happens after the moment of merger. On the other hand, what we have seen already is actually a huge variety of electromagnetic signals. And we here in the talk will focus mostly on stuff in the optical, ultraviolet, and infrared from the kilonova. Very briefly about the GRB, but I will not talk about X-ray and radio flares that are connected to binary neutron stars. And I will also not cover another messenger that comes from binary neutron stars, namely neutrinos. It's shaded here because we haven't seen neutrinos from binary neutron star mergers. In my personal opinion, it will also take a lot of time until we see them, simply if you just look at merger rates and the probability to see neutrinos from binary neutron star mergers. This is quite uncertain, even with the next generation of neutrino detectors. But neutrinos in the simulations and in the description of the matter that is ejected is, of course, a key ingredient. It determines the electron fraction of ejected material and therefore determines actually, a lot of the electromagnetic counterparts are connected to neutrinos. So neutrino physics has to be included, although neutrinos as an own messenger, this will take some time before it will be seen. And I will start with gravitational waves a little bit. And as I said, we all know that we have seen GW17817, and I will not talk about details here because you all know this, but I want to highlight a few things, namely GW17817 was an example of what we would have expected before. So we would have expected that we have an almost equal mass merger, because this is what we have seen with electromagnetic observations in our galaxy looking at binary neutron stars, and with masses around 1.35, 1.4 times the mass of the Sun of the individual star. So GW17817 was basically the vanilla binary neutron star merger that we would have guessed. But GW190425, so the second event that was observed as a binary neutron star merger, already proved some of our expectations wrong, because it was seen with significantly higher masses. So the total mass of the system was around 3.2, which is higher than the total mass of any observed electromagnetic binary neutron star system in our galaxy. And this is, at least for me, it was a little bit surprising when I saw this first, because this showed that while GW17817 was, let's say, the beginning of gravitational wave astronomy with binary neutron stars, 19045 proved, not really our expectations, as a slight exaggeration, but some of our expectations, and maybe not wrong, but we should have changed some of our, let's say, attitudes. And this is a very good motivation for numerical relativity simulations in a variety of the binary neutron star parameter space. And this is what we did over several years. So you see here a variety of our simulations that we do with a code that's called BEM. Some simulations also with a code developed by David Radice called THC. And of course, not just me, but also the University of Jena or Florida University. So this is a real collaboration doing these simulations. And this enables us to look at simulations for various binary parameters. As I said, GW17817, almost equal mass, 1.35 solar masses, where the masses of the neutron stars is our vanilla waveform that everybody produced very often and uses as a test case. But we're also able to produce high mass ratio simulations with mass ratio of 2, even beyond. High mass simulations like 19425, where we immediately form black hole. And if you want to go more extreme, then we can do precessing simulations where the entire orbit of the brain precesses. And we can also look at eccentric mergers. And the important thing is always that I want to highlight that we use a consistent description, consistent initial data, which means that we solve Einstein's equations together with the equations of the general relativistic hydrodynamics, which allows us to get, let's say, an accurate description of the system, so that we can use the simulations for waveform model development. If you do approximations on the sides, then you always run potentially into the issue that you see slight deviations, but you're not sure whether this might come from too large constraint violations initially, or whether this is related to real physics that you want to investigate. So it's very important that you really make sure that you solve full Einstein equations without approximations and also the equations for general relativistic hydrodynamics. And we did so by simulating this was the first data release that we did a few years ago, and we are preparing a second release In this first release, we had about 400 individual simulations. And you see here that we varied the total mass, the mass ratio, the spins, eccentricities, the tidal deformabilities, and so on for various equations of state, various resolutions, and so on. So we made on purpose all our data publicly available. And if you look at the user statistics, so at least who looked at the data and so on, you see that this is actually of common interest for the community to have such large varieties of bioinitial star waveforms. And all this sounds pretty cool. However, I want to highlight one thing in terms of these simulations going back. The time scale that I show here is for these simulations in geometric units scaled by the total mass. And even for the longest simulations that we did, this doesn't exceed a quarter or up to half a second. And half a second already takes months on a supercomputer, as you all know. And the issue is that for real life gravitational wave astronomy, this is consequently not applicable. We can't directly use for bioinitial stars numerical relativity simulations for an understanding and for an interpretation of gravitational waves from bioinitial stars. You know this, but I just want to highlight it again. There's two reasons. First of all, the bioinitial star systems are in the observable band from advanced LIGO for up to maybe 2 minutes currently. In O4, this will be even longer. And for ET, for example, we have a bioinitial star merger potentially half an hour or hours before the merger in the band. We can't produce so long waveforms as bioinitial star simulations, so with full numerical relativity. And on the other hand, if you do parameter estimation, and the top right here shows it for the binary black hole merger, GW19-04-5, you usually compute about 100 million templates to find the best matching parameters. And of course, I mean, we took probably 3-4 years to produce these 400 simulations. Having a real template bank or something like this is completely unfeasible, and I think will be unfeasible actually. I will not say.
Can I ask a question here? Sure. So these 400 simulations, I mean, how do they compare with like a simulation from other codes, and what's the phase difference, for example?
So we did a few comparisons, and there is also an ongoing comparison project where I think also the people from Perimeter are actually involved in producing data, if I remember correctly. So the phase accuracy, of course, depends. And let me go back to the plot. Depends on the resolution that you apply. So I can't give a clear statement of the phase accuracy. And you see in the top row the grid spacing, and therefore you see at some places actually multiple dots because we did them for several resolutions. For the highest simulations, highest resolutions, we have a accuracy for 10, 15 orbits, maybe half a radiant up to radiant uncertainty for the highest resolutions. And we compared this with between BAM and THC for a few selected cases. And the difference between the two codes are always within the uncertainties that we estimate. And the good thing is also that if we do the analysis for multiple resolutions and so on, then we've also find that actually the phase accuracy or the phase difference between resolutions shows a clear convergence order. Because of the Newton star surface and because of the usage of the limiter where we have Vino Z, this falls actually to second order from theoretical arguments if you have a discontinuity at the Newton star surface, and we see the second order. So that if we have 2, 3 or more simulations, we can also use Richardson and extrapolation to get a better guess. But yeah, ballpark number, half a radiant or a radiant for about 10 orbits for the higher resolutions.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Good. Then what I want to highlight, of course, now when we talk about gravitational astronomy is and I did this already, that these numerical simulations, they're a great testbed. And the question that you ask already goes into this direction. What's the accuracy of the NAS simulation? Because then we can compare on the one hand with post-Newtonian approximations, on the other hand with effective one-body approximations, and try to understand how accurate are the models. And for this, we need a very reliable estimate of the numerical relativity error. And therefore, this error budget and this clean convergence order is so crucial and so important. I'm honest, from these 400 simulations, you can't use all the 400 for waveform model development, but only the ones that have very high resolution and only the ones that have multiple resolutions to actually assess properly your numerical relativity uncertainty. But if you do this, then you see that there are corners of the parameter space where you can actually improve. Post-Newtonian theory, you know this, has a problem, an inherent problem, because when you come close to the moment of merger, it becomes inaccurate by construction because the velocities become very large. The effective one-body model overcomes slightly this issue, but if you don't use extra techniques like post-adiabatic approximations or like reduced order models, then this is too slow to be actually used for parameter estimation. So what we did, and this I'll highlight because I like the timing a little bit, a few months before actually GW70817, is that motivated by all these pharmacological models that are produced by the Cardiff group, the Spanish group in Mallorca and so on, we used a similar approach actually for the tidal contributions, describing really just the tidal contribution in Barnard Nichol star systems. And this uses all the knowledge from PN. So we used a fitting function, let's put it this way, that when we expand it, this is shown on the next slide, we have here a Pradé approximant. And when we expand the Pradé approximant, we actually recover all the known PN coefficients, and tidal effects are known up to 7.5 PN so far. So we recover all these, but we have higher order coefficients, let's say, hidden in this Pradé approximant that we can calibrate to EUB and to NR simulations. And again, just using the highest resolution NR simulations. And the good thing of this approach is that first of all, it's very flexible. So you have a binary black hole waveform model where people develop multiple ones, phenom models, EUB models, and we can add this, just these tidal contributions to the model to describe actually tidal waveform models, right? For binary neutron stars or black hole neutron stars would also work in this respect. This gives us a possibility also to describe generic systems like precessing binary neutron stars. So far, the only precessing binary neutron star models are using this approximation. It also is a significant speed up because you have for the computation of a single simulation or for a single waveform starting at the same frequency as GW70817 was observed, you need about 100 milliseconds. So this is then doable and usable for parameter estimation. And here is, for example, one comparison. The shaded region is the NR uncertainty and the solid line is the difference with this model. And then you see differences to other EUB models and you see that you're compatible. You're compatible with just a very simplified phenomenological approach, which you can write down analytically. And therefore you have a simplistic model that actually is just phenomenological. So the theory behind it might not be the nicest. It isn't the nicest compared to other approaches, but it is, let's say, working quite effectively, which is a nice thing. And we're continuously upgrading this. We use it also for black hole neutron star investigations currently. So this is actually a work in progress. And the important thing is now the applications. The application that you all know is the parameter estimation for gravitational wave signals. So for example, for GW70817, you see that the PN prediction is actually not as tight as the NR tidal predictions, but this is just from the fact that NR tidal contributions, phase contributions are stronger for the same tidal deformability than post-Newtonian theory. So this is, of course, use case of the waveform models, but maybe not the most interesting one. So one other application, not just for this waveform model, but for binary neutron star waveform models that I want to highlight because it's very timely, is actually the usage in the investigation of lensing. Here I'm talking about strong lensing. So as electromagnetic waves, also gravitational waves can be lensed. And what happens if you have a gravitational wave moving close by a galaxy cluster, at leading order, what will happen is that you have a magnification of the amplitude. The phasing doesn't change. Of course, this is aligned in time and the lensed image will happen at a different time and so on. But if you align this, the leading change, or the main change, is actually the amplitude. And this magnification, because what determines the amplitude mostly is, of course, once the distance and the mass of the system, leads immediately to wrong mass estimate. So what you would do for binary neutrons as a source that is lensed, you would see actually a source, and this is shown here in blue, actually injected signal, you would see that it's the observed mass is larger. For example, like for 19.425, you would see a mass that is quite large. But on the other hand, since the phasing is not affected, and you need a waveform model like this and a tidal one to extract phase information, you would measure tidal effects. And these tidal effects would not fit together with this very high mass measurements, because usually very massive neutron stars don't deform so easily. You wouldn't measure strong tidal effects. Consequently, if you measure tidal effects for very massive neutron stars, either this would mean something for the equation of state, which would be super interesting, or it would mean that the source is actually lensed. We can say the 19.425 was not very likely not lensed. I mean, we don't see any tidal effects there, which is consistent with our expectation of this, let's say, system which is far away and very massive. And therefore, I say it's very timely. Just I think 3 hours ago, there was a webinar of the LIGO Scientific Collaboration where they actually describe for the first catalog or first part of the O3 analysis, actually the lensing, and that there's no lensing. And this also is related slightly to this analysis that we did there. So it was applied here. And yeah, nevertheless, this is a use case which might become important for O4 or O5 if you see, let's say, something that is inconsistent between the measurement of tidal effects and mass measurements. And another application that I think is a nice one that goes even beyond O4 and O5, namely to the Einstein telescope, is to try to extract not just the mass-weighted tidal deformability lambda tilde, but the individual lambdas. So this event here is a not very loud one for the ET. It's, if I remember correctly, an SNR of around 30 or 40. And you see, maybe 50, it's less than 100. And for ET, we will see a lot of these systems per year. We'll see that we can get slum estimates of the individual tidal deformabilities, but significantly less than for lambda tilde. This is already true for GW7817, and this is always true. We measure lambda tilde always better.
Can I ask you a question real quick? Sorry.
Sure. Yeah.
In that study, what sort of uncertainties do you guys assume about waveform models or calibration for ET? Right? Like, you can't calibrate the detector perfectly, so you have uncertainty about your wave, like your actual phasing and stuff. Was any of that built into that study?
No, it wasn't. Okay. The reason is the following, and I have a backup slide at the end, but I can explain it. We are so far at a point where it is clear that for the Einstein telescope, waveform systematics that we have currently is way too large. I mean, 17.817 and so on, we're determined by statistical uncertainties. With a loud event in O4 or 5, this might change with respect to the systematic uncertainties from waveforms, and we are way away from this. So this study aimed more towards, and I will show this later, extracting individual parameters. And we injected and recovered with the same waveform model to first of all see whether this, the approach we want to follow, is in principle possible. Then I completely agree that in real life application, you need to check for calibration uncertainties, which we also neglected in the sense that we just used the PST that is available and just Gaussian noise, which for long in-spiral signals and so on, the approach that we used is too simplified. And the waveform model systematic is another thing that is crucial and it has to be addressed, let's say, in the next 12, 14 years when we have time to work on it, because we are far away from having the accuracy that we need.
Okay, thanks. We don't need to spend more time on this, but thanks. Okay.
And so what we tried here is for a single source extract these individual parameters. And what we wanted to see is actually that we can, in principle, use third generation detectors to extract or to verify the Yagi-Unes, for example, quasi-universal relations that connect the quadrupole moment with the tidal deformability. So what we did, and this, as I said, we injected one waveform model and recovered with the same one. We injected the Yagi-Unz relations. So we picked lambdas according to a given equation of state and randomly distributed masses and spins and so on, and computed the quadrupole moment accordingly to this relation, and then saw, I mean, checked how much, how good we can actually extract both quantities, and found actually from a set of 120 injections that we did that we can recover, let's say, a linear approximation of a quasi-universe relations from these setups. And we compared this also with a modified relation, quotation marks. We have been very lazy. Again, this is not super theoretically motivated, but we just divided the quadrupole moment by two to see whether we can see this. And the issue is that the quadrupole moment, of course, I mean, spin-spin effects that are determined by the quadrupole moment enter at 2pn, so significantly earlier, but are suppressed due to the relatively small spins that you would expect for one Newton size or for Newton size in general. And therefore, we went here the way that actually we injected quite a different number of systems with a very different tidal tidal deformability quadrupole moment. When we just, I mean, small changes in the quasi-universal relation from Yagi and Unz for the set of 120 simulations we wouldn't see, let's put it this way, even with the T, but with a larger set and with more statistics and maybe more sophisticated techniques, this would be possible. And this is just a proof of principle that quasi-universal relations for single neutron stars can be extracted in principle from gravitational wave signals. Quasi-universal relations, on the other hand, also play a very important role, and there it will be easier actually to extract them in the post-merger phase of binary neutron stars. And for this purpose, just a reminder, the emission frequency shortly after the moment of merger mostly comes from actually the motion of the remnant that is deformed. It's at a very clear FMO peak frequency, and you can measure this frequency, and you find that there's a quasi-universal relation when you actually, this kappa 2 is related to the tidal deformability. So if you plot this as a function of the tidal deformability, so a quantity that determines things from the inspiral also determines the main emission frequency in the post-merger phase that happens at a frequency that is around 3 kilohertz. So we haven't seen this yet, and it will take some time until we see it. We came to the conclusion that actually it can't just be the inspiral contribution that determines the main emission frequency in the post-merger phase. We also introduced another parameter, namely the maximum mass of a non-rotating neutron star with respect to the remnant, because the closer you are to the black hole formation, the more compact is actually the remnant, and the higher is the frequency that you emit in this post-merger phase. And with this, let's say, updated universal relation, based again on our numerical relativity simulation, so this is always our test bed, we did an injection study again. This was done by a PhD student at NICAF, where we injected numerical relativity simulations. And from the inspiral, we can actually measure this parameter. We know the lambda tilde, we know some estimate of the TOV mass, right? We know that it's around 2 to maybe 2.3 times the solar mass. And we actually have some mass measurement from the inspiral. So from the inspiral, we already get an estimate of this particular parameter that determines the main emission frequency after the merger. And then on the other hand, we have this quasi-universal relation. So we have some expected value, let's say, for the post-merger frequency. If we now inject just the post-merger part and we start small, right? We start with an SNR of 2, and then we see that we can't with an SNR of 2, this maybe is around 40, 50 of the entire signal. We can't see the post-merger frequency. If we increase with higher SNRs, so basically increase the decrease the distance to the source, then at some point we are able to measure in some uncertainties. This is always, I think, the one sigma uncertainty. We can measure the post-merger part. And the interesting thing is now actually where the estimate from the inspiral, the estimate from the post-merger part, and where the quasi-universal relation falls together. Of course, in our test case, this had to fall together because we used numerical relativity simulations that actually were used for creating the quasi-universal relations. So, right, everything was falling together within the uncertainties that we would expect. Of course, there's some shifts around because we have Gaussian noise added and so on. But what could happen now is that actually you measure something from the interval, you measure some post-merger peak, and you have a quasi-universe relation that do not line up. Either this could mean that GR is wrong. I wouldn't bet on this because there's a significantly higher uncertainty in our treatment of some microphysics in the NR simulations, whether there might be a phase transition that shifts the quasi-universe relation or other effects that we don't take into account. But nevertheless, if we see some kind of discrepancy, then this would actually be a very nice indicator that we have to improve our post-merger modeling. And of course, this is, again, just a very simplified case. We have a very simplified post-merger waveform model, but it shows the direction where actually future studies can go. And these future studies focus then, of course, more onto the post-merger regime. And the post-merger regime currently is, however, already indirectly tested through electromagnetic observations, because the ejected material, the short gamma ray burst, and so on, this, of course, comes from the merger remnant, right, when the merger remnant is produced. And just to give you a brief, to remind you, when we have this merger, we have different outcomes, right, that we can have. We can have right away a black hole formation, or the other extreme scenario, form a massive neutron star that survives there and is stable. Already on a qualitative level, we could say that if we plot now the mass of our simulations, again, refer to our simulation catalog, with respect to the tidal deformabilities, we have seen a very bright electromagnetic counterpart for GW17817. And this rules out the scenario that right away we formed a black hole. Because if we form right away a black hole, we wouldn't eject a lot of matter, we wouldn't have a massive disk that then creates the GRB and so on. On the other hand, from the measurement of the tidal deformability from GW17817, we also know that the tidal deformability has an upper bound of like 700, 800. I mean, this is very, really just a qualitative description. And this tells you right away that the merger remnant should be a supermassive or hypermassive neutron star. There are more sophisticated studies by other people, also here in the audience, who looked into detail in the lifetime of the remnant and so on. But this is just, let's say, the first argument. And we, of course, also were motivated to do this in on a quantitative level, not just this qualitative hand-waving arguments. And for this, it's I remind you again that the kilonova is produced from this neutron-rich outflow, can produce heavy elements inside this neutron-rich outflow that then triggers the kilonova when the matter actually expands. It becomes transparent, and then you can see the kilonova on the time scale of a few hours to 2-3 weeks after the merger. And here's a comparison with a kilonova model compared to actually the bolometric luminosity measured for GW17817 or its kilonova counterpart AT2017GFO. And to now go back to the binary properties, you have to link actually the properties of the kilonova, which is determined by the ejector. So how much mass is ejected, what is the velocity of the ejector, what's the composition, and so on, with the properties of the system. And this means that you have to understand where the ejector comes from. And this ejector comes on the one hand from tidal ejector around the moment of merger, or it can come from disk winds, so that you have a wind that is actually produced by the merger remnant. You have the black hole surrounded by an accretion disk, and from time to time, either due to magnetic-driven winds or to transducer-driven winds, so there are important works from Daniel, for example, on these kind of aspects, you can eject a huge amount of matter from this disk, so you need a disk estimate that you then can use. And we now used our numerical relativity simulations and this connection to actually look at full radiative transfer simulations and at the best matching description of the light curves to then extract the binary properties. So we have here AT2017GFO and all the data points there. And what we did is we had full radiative transfer simulations, and these simulations produced, for example, by colleagues in Sweden, Mattia Buller, and he produces a set of these simulations for various parameters, different dynamic ejector, wind ejector, different geometry, different opening angles, and so on. And then we use Gaussian process regression, very similar to surrogate modeling of gravitational waves, to actually do a Bayesian inference with a kilonova and to extract the binary properties. And here's one of our first studies. We're just looking at the kilonova and this analysis here and the link back to the binary properties. We could see that actually the kilonova disfavors small tidal deformabilities and also very large mass ratios. Mass ratio estimate, of course, is in agreement with the measurement of the gravitational waves. The tidal deformability, and this is an interesting aspect, is complementary to gravitational waves because there you mostly get upper bounds on the tidal deformability. So you rule out very large Newton star radii, while the kilonova rules out very small Newton star radii. And of course, this is a very interesting aspect because this tells you that you can use actually both approaches to get a better understanding about the equation of state. And this brings us back to this nuclear physics input from the beginning. And this slide, I will go through it step by step, is one of the key science results, I would say, from our study of the last 1 or 2 years. And it's also related to a lot of work that Reed, for example, is doing. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to develop a, let's say, nuclear physics multi-messenger framework to actually go include as much astrophysical observations as we have. To start, we use a motivated, let's say, set of equations of state using chiral effective field theory up to around 1.5 times nuclear saturation density. These are 5,000 equations of state. Just for this study, we used 5,000. Currently, we produced more to have a better estimate and overview. And you see that chiral EFT, if you just have it active up to 1.5 times nuclear saturation density, and then use a very general, actually, speed of sound extrapolation, you were even allowing for phase transitions and all these kinds of things. And we made it in a way, the equations of state, that we have a flat radius prior for a neutron star of 1.4 times the mass of the sun. This is our input, this is our prior for the study. And the next one uses actually maximum mass constraints. You get an understanding about the maximum mass or constraints of the maximum mass if you look at massive radio pulsars, right? Because you observe these pulsars, so you know that neutron stars with these masses exist. You can combine this to get a lower bound on the maximum mass of neutron stars. On the other hand, from the qualitative description, I already told you that GW17, Alcon7 produced a black hole. So you also know that if you have the mass of GW17, Alcon7, subtract the ejector mass that you have, subtract the radiated energy and gravitational waves and so on, then you get an upper bound on the maximum mass of neutron stars. And what I show here is this purple band actually is, I think, the 2 sigma region for this maximum mass constraint. And this means that all these equations of state have to lie within this region or should lie and are favored when they lie in this region. It's not that we apply any hard cuts, but it's strongly favored if it's inside this region. And this already changes the radius constraint. The next one is a nicer observation here. The first nicer observation, nicer, you probably all know this, is an X-ray telescope on board of the ISS. And this measured the pulsar PSR0030 in 2019 and gave a radius mass uncertainty. And this also can be incorporated actually in the analysis and gives a further improved measurement of the radius. Then we are dealing with gravitational wave astronomy. So we redid the analysis from the LIGO-Virgo collaboration and with an improved waveform model, and we get actually the masses of the two neutron stars and improve the final radius measurement. Then we do our Bayesian inference for the kilonova, again, get the individual masses and improved radius measurement. We did the same for 19.0425 and already have a much tighter measurement of the radius. And finally, what you can do, but here this, the uncertainties are of course larger, is that you also in principle can include that for 19.0425, you have not seen any EM counterpart. You can include this because a lot of EM colleagues try to find a counterpart. And they looked out, reached, I don't hope, I hope that I don't say something wrong, but I think reached about magnitude of about 21. And then we know that actually we haven't seen anything which gives you an upper bound on the absolute luminosity of the kilonova, and consequently gives you a lower bound on the mass of the system, because more massive systems produce not as bright counterparts, so we can incorporate this. But you see here in the bottom panel that this doesn't really add anything if you have already the gravitational wave information included, because the gravitational waves here are significantly better than the non-detection of a counterpart to 19.425. So this was a study we did last year. Luckily, there are more observations ongoing. And one is, for example, the NICER measurement. And you see here a plot for pressure versus number density for band of the equation of state from before. This blue band is actually the equation of state that we had before. We use chiral effective field theory up to 1.5 times nuclear saturation density. Gravitational waves for the normal neutron stars, normal in quotation mark, 1.4, 1.5 times nuclear saturation density. Probe matter up to 4 times nuclear saturation density, because there's a center central density that reach inside neutron stars. With a kilonova or gamma ray burst from GAB 170817, you actually go beyond this because you probe matter even before black hole formation. And now NICER observed actually a pulsar that is very massive, 0740. It's a 2 solar mass pulsar, which then actually probes, let's say, density up to 4 or 5 times nuclear saturation density. And if you include this, then you see that if you have, and here's just one of these two analyses, if you add this, then you see that you slightly actually improve the measurements in this uncertainty of the equation of state band. If you look here at the mass versus radius for these two observations, you shift slightly to a higher estimated mass, the bounds stay more or less the same, simply because this NICER measurement, you see here the uncertainties, 1 sigma and 2 sigma, predict a very a slightly larger radius than one would have guessed initially. And this is also quite new. So I think this NICER results were finally published or released last week. So this is just a very recent study. And more recent, and then I'm almost done, is an ongoing study that one can also include and then really has a nuclear physics multi-messenger framework. And these are nuclear physics experiments. So what we do currently, we work together with people in Darmstadt, experimentalists actually, who a few years ago, I mean, in 2013, there was a proposal, and then in 2016, I think, they did experiments where they had gold and smashed this gold together in terms of a heavy ion collision, and then measured actually during this collision how a so-called fireball is produced and then expands. And the expansion of this fireball depends on the density and also on the derivative of the energy with respect to the density. So the density is denoted by an N. And this pressure and the energy, the binding energy, depends on the symmetric nuclear matter and an asymmetric part that tells you how much away you're actually from having equal proton and neutrons inside the matter, going to having more and more neutrons like in a neutron star. And if you're now far away from having equal mass, if your neutrons and protons present inside these fireballs, at some places this is the case, and at these places the pressure for the expansion of the fireball is actually different, then you can actually extract information about the equation of state directly from this heavy ion collision experiment. And of course, this information can be incorporated in a framework like the one that I outlined before. And as I said, this is preliminary. So these are really preliminary studies where you see that we start again with the chiral effective field theory framework. We have some multi-messenger astro constraints, all the ones that I showed you before, except for the NICER observation, we're just including it in it. And now we have heavy ion collisions that actually probe matter. This is the purple region here, up to about 2 times nuclear saturation density. And you see that this also adds an information, and this is a very important information because it bridges slightly the gap from astro observations that actually constrain matter at very high densities and chiral effective field theory that constrains matter at lower densities. And you can see this here, where you look at the pressure with respect to the number density. If you look at the combined Astro and Hick constraint at the 2.5 times nuclear saturation density, then the final constraint actually, so blue shaded region, purely comes from Astro. So this, right? This is the probability. And the Hick constraint is not very, is not driving the final result. This is contrary to actually looking at about 1.5 times nuclear saturation density, where the Astro constraint is quite different from the final constraint, because most information comes from the heavy ion collisions. If you do heavy ion collision nuclear physics theory up to 1.5 times nuclear saturation density, and then Astro constraints. And as I said, this is an ongoing study. Of course, you can also relate this to the mass radius measurement and get even tighter constraints. The last 2 minutes, then I'm really done. As I said, I wanted to briefly mention also that you can use these multi-messenger analyses to actually determine the Hubble constant. And you all know this. Know how to measure the Hubble constant and so on. And you see here an image of our telescope in Potsdam. So let's assume we see actually a lot of galaxies, and in one of these galaxies we have a Barnard-Newton star merger. Then what we really need to do, because we know the host galaxy, we know the redshift, we need to measure the distance. And you know the approach by the gravitational waves. So we just have gravitational wave astronomy, we do again the parameter estimation, and we get the distance. Another way of getting the distance actually uses the kilonova, because also there we have Bayesian inference, we have the distance as a pre-parameter, and one can even standardize kilonovas in a similar fashion as supernovae. This is more uncertain than gravitational wave astronomy. The error bar is much, much larger, but nevertheless, it gives you complementary information. And if you add this, actually, so add gravitational waves and the kilonova measurements, then you get a tighter constraint on the distance measurement and on the Hubble constraint. And this shows you again that actually, if you combine all these measurements, gravitational waves, electromagnetic signals, and so on, then you get a reasonably tight and reasonably good understanding about the Hubble constant. And already at these error bars here, one sigma uncertainties, can start to go into the direction of favoring measurements that exist in the literature. And you don't only have to apply this for GW17817, you can also use actually kilonova candidates that have been observed before in combination to GRBs to do the same measurement from the kilonova. Of course, again, there it's even more uncertain. And to summarize, so I hope I gave you a nice overview of what the work that we're doing in terms of numerical relativity simulations and why they're important for developing waveform models, and also for let's say connecting kilonova observations with Barnard properties, and the way forward to get tighter constraints on the equation of state and also good measurements of the Hubble constant is, of course, by combining different messengers, electromagnetic and gravitational waves, but also input from nuclear physics experiment as well as observations, or other astro observations, X-ray like NISA and so on. This is all from my side, and thanks for listening.
Okay, thank you, Tim, for the very nice talk. Questions? Oh, Will.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for the nice talk. The question I had was, you discussed how there's a number of uncertainties that go into predicting what the kilonova light curve should be. From a neutron star merger, one is like whether it's dynamical ejector or some wind from the accretion disk. And I guess another one is just all the uncertainties about the nuclear physics that go into the R process itself in the kilonova emission. Like for example, I think Jennifer Barnes and collaborators in the past few months put out a paper saying that it could be sort of an order of magnitude rate, like variability in just the light curves that you expect from a given amount of ejected material, just due to the uncertainties in the nuclear physics there. So I was wondering if you could comment on how you incorporate those kinds of uncertainties when you're trying to get out these measurements.
Yeah, so it's a very good point. So I mean, first of all, when we did these the studies that I showed earlier with all the panels, then we used a number of different kilonova models for comparison. This is the first starting point, but of course this is more qualitative. So that we always backed up that things are in agreement, and we used for example kilonova models from Kaizen et al. So I think Jennifer also were involved in this work, Mattia Bula, then people in Amsterdam and so on. So different kilonova models, like comparing gravitation wave models. But nevertheless, there's a huge uncertainty. And this uncertainty produces in, if you assume small uncertainties in the modeling, produces inconsistent results. So then you see that you are dominated by statistical, by systematic uncertainty. So what we do in addition to just assuming the uncertainty from the measurement of the observation, we also ad hoc add a very large uncertainty of a one magnitude error bar to the kilonova model itself. And there's a study by Jack Hansel, for example, who showed that actually this one magnitude uncertainty covers reasonably well the different models, so the predictions agree and so on. But of course, on the other hand, makes the constraints that we get from it looser, because of course, when you assume a larger uncertainty in the full Bayesian parameter estimation, then the final result's less constraining. But this was our way of actually trying to be on the safe side, so that we use a very large uncertainty for the modeling itself, that we compared with three different, at least three different models always, and to try to ensure that the parameter estimation that we get out and the results that we get out, that they are consistent. If we now want to go on and want to investigate more kilonova and want to get a smaller error bar, then I think progress on the modeling side, both in numerical relativity and these relations, which also are highly uncertain, and we try to connect, combine this uncertainty also, and the modeling of the kilonova has to be improved, essentially to avoid that you're really hitting systematic uncertainties and trying to get properties or measure properties not accurately enough. Yeah, this is how we included it, and I completely agree that there's more work needed to get tighter measurements.
Okay, thanks.
Any additional questions?
Hey, Tim, along those lines, could you maybe talk a little bit about what assumptions go into the fact that 1904-25, the fact that those masses you find to be informative, are there any assumptions you have to make in your analysis to make that case?
You mean for the EM non-detection or for the gravitation wave part?
Both.
Okay. I mean, for the, and no, I'm really trying to go to this the slide. So for the gravitation wave part, we don't make any assumption. I mean, we assume it's a binary Newton star. We use a binary Newton star waveform model. This is the assumption. But there's nothing more in addition. And you see that actually the error bars are very large. Right. So if you look here at this H panel where you have the kilonova measurement and then going to include 1904-25, this adds almost nothing for the uncertainty error bar. It shifts slightly the mass measurement, I mean, the mean value to a larger value, but this is not statistically significant. So let's put it this way, 1904-25 is included. The assumption is that it's a binary Newton star because we use a binary Newton star waveform model, although IMA phenom PV2 and Atali V2, of course, also works for lambda equal to zero, but we sample on equation of state and so on. So this really means that we assume these are Newton stars. But the information is very small, if not even existent. It's more a proof that you can add more and more gravitational wave events in this framework if we see a source with smaller masses closer and therefore measure tidal deformabilities for more massive system and so on, this can be incorporated. And to the EM side, I mean, you going back here, you see that this line here is even dashed because even the authors were uncertain whether one should include it or not. It's a point that for the non-existing Killanova to 19.425, people covered, I don't want to say the wrong word number here, but I think in total 60-70% of the sky location, 95% or 90% sky location. So this is already an uncertainty that when I don't exactly know how to model it, namely that it might be that the place where 19.425 happened was never observed within telescopes, it was accurately enough to place any constraint. So therefore, this is a very, very big if. The second one is, of course, that you measure the absolute magnitude, or you know that actually you measure the absolute magnitude because you measure the distance to the source from the gravitational waves, and then you know how good your telescope is, and this places a constraint on the maximum luminosity. And also there is no additional information other than 19.425 is a neutron star. Again, this is an assumption that it's a neutron star. And for this last part of the non-detection, there is a big assumption that you covered the region when 19.425 actually emerged.
Okay, thanks. One point of clarification though, for the gravitational wave side, right? You have mm-hmm. the masses. Do you truncate your mass prior at the maximum mass for that EOS? Or do you integrate over masses above the maximum mass, but then set lambda to zero? There is a difference between those approaches, right?
The first one, because what we do is that we don't really sample on lambda. We sample on the equation of state. And we only allow that we have actually a sample which is covered by the equation of state. So we don't allow masses larger. So therefore I say we assume it's a neutron star.
Right. So that, I mean, right. But there's no data that forces that to be the case, right? So that is an additional assumption. Yeah,
this is an assumption. Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Maybe I can also ask a question. So you mentioned about this test for Q-Love relation in bioneutron stars. So what is the motivation of doing that? Let's say you measure some kind of, you see some kind of violation of that relation, doesn't mean it's a strange equilibrium state. So the other related question I have is, it seems you need high spins to measure Q. So what's the spin have you assumed for that? And how likely do you have a highly spinning neutron star in binaries?
Yeah, so I'll try to go back to the slide. So first of all, the motivation is rather to see whether we can measure these kind of quasi-universe relations. And this is all. It's then the question how you would interpret violations and so on. I mean, we just thought it would be nice if not just based on theoretical predictions or so on, but also from the data itself, you might be able to extract these relations. And it seems that you can, and this is true if you have highly spinning neutron stars. The point is that we had a very large spin distribution, I think flat between 0.4, minus 0.4 and 0.4, which is very large for neutron stars, 0.3, I would need to check. But this is very fastly spinning for neutron stars in a binary system. On the other hand, what one really has to point out that we used 120 sources for computation reasons, and you get even information if you have a spin of 0.4, 0.5. Of course, the information is much smaller for the individual event, but the method stacks them up. And if you look at prediction rates for the Einstein telescope, then you easily have 10,000 or 100,000 sources per year. So even if they are slowly spinning, and slowly spinning means you're 0.02, 0.03 or so, I mean, might not be slowly already for binary emission cells, but even if you have these sources which have been observed in our galaxy, you can extract something and then you can add them together. So this study really is a proof of principle where it can be done. In reality, what you have to do this for a much, much larger set of simulations, which we simply couldn't afford. And therefore we went the, let's say, lazy people way of using higher spins.
Okay, thanks. Any additional questions for Tim? Oh, if not, let's thank Tim again for this wonderful talk.
Yeah. Thank you, Tim.